observation I just made. When the Echo Link goes into that sideband mode, it's at the exact moment that the east-west link drops. So if you're listening on 375, it goes down at exactly the same time that the Echo Link goes into the sideband mode, NY2H.
That's good information, Lou. I can explain that. We're sharing a port, and the port's supposed to be running half duplex. It winds up going full duplex, and that's what happens. It forms this weird feedback.
Okie doke. That's it. I'm clear. The other piece of information on topic is W2LIE has a lot about scanners and protocols. He does a seminar at Ham Radio University. One of the more interesting ones he did was about using two of those Russian dongles to simulate a trunking receiver, where one dongle did the control and the other dongle would follow that and get on the particular frequency, you know, with agility. And very cheaply, the dongles are only about $10 each, and a laptop computer, and you have yourself a scanning trunking scanner, NY2H. I'll be clear, I'm listening out in the mobile. Dick.
Yeah, anybody who goes to Philip's website, W2LIE, is it W2LIE or is it K2LIE? If it's Philip, lots of information is available when you get to the right one. When you get to the right one by going to... when you go to QRZ.com. Let's see, if Bob is available, W2OSR, I've got some information for you, Bob. W2OSR, are you there? K2RIW?
Yeah, go ahead, I'm here.
I'm a little bit forgetful. I think you did say 11 miles, 2417 megahertz. And if it was 11 miles, it comes out 125 decibels of free space loss, 125.0. Was 11 miles the right number, or did I remember it wrong, Bob? Go ahead.
A little over 11, but that's close enough.
Okay, now that you know the amount of free space loss, you know the amount of gain you've got in the transmitting antenna, the number of watts, 1 watt is plus 30 dBm, and the only other real missing piece of information now is how good is the receiver, what is its sensitivity. Eric was telling me last night that a number of these things that people are using on 802.11 have got a terrible sensitivity, sometimes like minus 70, which is equivalent to a 40-some-odd decibel noise figure. No self-respecting receiver designer would design something that bad, but in the case of something that's intended just for wireless communication within your house as a router, that's more than good enough. Okay, the original person who asked this question that Eric has been answering was Mike, NY2 Yankee Yankee Lima. Don, good question, Mike. I know we didn't give you a nice, simple answer. Unfortunately, it's not a nice, simple answer. But it's a developing technology. And so at least you know a little bit more of the ingredients. You're allowed to come back as many times you want and ask more information. NY2 Yankee Yankee Lima on Echo Link for any other fills. K2RIW, you got a mic.
Yeah, the call sign is November 2, Yankee, Yankee, Lima. And, now you guys have a wealth of information out there. And like Eric said, now that I also have to worry about if the transmission is encrypted, which more or less puts another, stumbling block down there. Now you guys, Eric and you, a wealth of information, all the other people that helped there. So, yeah, digital is, I guess, the future, and we'll see what happens. And to YYL, back to you, Dick.
And good luck with that project, Mike. And as you find out more, please come back and stick with us from time to time. Earlier, I did hear Bill, Alpha Charlie 2, India Sierra, sign in. And I heard him say, nothing heard. So I'm listening right now to the 375 machine. And so I'm coming out of that, and he's nearest that machine. So, Bill, I think you had a question and or comment. So give it to us right now, Bill. Alpha Charlie 2, India Sierra, K2RIW. Okay, yeah, maybe Bill's not there. K2GJE. Go right ahead with your question or comment. K2RIW.
Good evening. Just curiosity, I wasn't able to stay up late enough. How did Eric solve the negative screen card problem, over?
When he was getting that negative screen current, two things were going on. One, he had a bypass capacitor on the screen that was arcing over when he went above 200 volts. I think they wanted something like 500 volts on that screen, so that had to be repaired. Also, so many of the controls had been disturbed in the process of removing the old tube that had a blown-out filament and plugging in the new tube. The way you had to literally take the transmitter apart, all of those controls got heavily disturbed. Therefore, the unit was quite far out of tuning. The plate circuit wasn't being resonated. And whenever you got a non-resonating plate circuit on a tetro tube with normal voltages on screen and plate, it will give you very negative screen current. So it was a matter of finding the right tuning to get the resonance, finding the right bypass capacitors that were blown out, and the lightning strike also has wiped out a whole lot of integrated circuits that are part of the protection network on that broadcast transmitter. It was an FM broadcast transmitter that runs something like 3,500 watts of output. So these broadcast guys get their hands into some real interesting pieces of hardware. K2GJE, K2LIW.
Thank you. Quite interesting. I have an old tetrode transmitter here that was built up, believe it or not, in the 50s that still runs. And I run it basically by watching screen current. When I have it loaded up, heavily loaded, the screen current will be at minimum. And I don't have data. I had data for 2,000 volts, but I don't use 2,000 volts. I use 1,500 volts, and I have a grid drive problem. Let me drop. Okay, I should be back. I heard a beep. I was at one time running like 12 milliamps of grid current, but I noticed that if I run even 10 milliamps, I get the same screen current. If I drop less than 10 milliamps, then the screen current starts to go up. I was just wondering where's the sweet spot between 10 milliamps and 12 milliamps. Over.
Each transmitting tube is different, Ed. Each transmitter is different. My only experience is my favorite tube is a 4CX250B. Forced air cooled ceramic external anode type 2, very popular among the VHF, UHF guys of 10 or 20 years ago. And so that so-called K2RIW Pearl kilowatt amplifier uses a pair of those tubes that are my favorites. And just like you, I found out that when the transmitter is giving you maximum power output in the Class C mode, that's the way I was running a Class C FM modulation going into it. Sideband linear is a little bit different, but in the FM mode, where you've got the minus 90 volts on the controller grid, something like plus 300, plus 350 on the screen grid, anywhere from 1500 to 2000 on the plate, that's not critical. It changes the power output, but doesn't change the way the tube behaves very much. And so, at maximum power output, when everything is really, really cranking, very close to 0 milliamps of screen current is observed. If I start seeing a negative screen current, I know that the loading is too heavy or out of resonance. If I start seeing positive screen current, I know that the loading is too light and in resonance. So monitoring screen grid current is an extremely good way of knowing if everything's going well. Of course, you look at plate current, and of course, you look at control grid current. In the case of the 4CX250B, whatever screen grid current you see, and you know what the voltage is, make sure there's a protection circuit, which in my case is a simple, let me drop.
Eric has a comment also.
Okay, we'll go over to Eric in a minute. So, in my case, it was a simple dropping resistor, making sure that the screen couldn't draw too much current without the voltage going all the way down the ground. And there's got to be a good Belisa resistor on the screen supply to protect you from negative screen current. But by monitoring that screen current, I could tell that the transmitter was working correctly, properly loaded, the plate circuit was resonated, the antenna was giving me reasonable visual, and so on. It was a real good test of how well the tube wasn't happy in the way it was being used right now. Control grid current, you got to make sure you have a stiff enough, in the case of Class C, a stiff enough voltage regulator on the control grid that can tolerate current flowing in either direction and still stay regulated. 10 or 15 milliamps of control grid current in either direction, at least 15 milliamps of screen grid current in either direction, you have to protect from those. You have to have circuitry that properly handles those if everything's going to work right. Now, because that broadcast transmitter, Eric has spent quite a number of hours tuning it, guarantee he's got a little bit more of the story than he'd like to give us. KE2EJ on Echolink, K2RIW on the TechNet. You've got it, Eric.
K2RIW, K2J, I don't know if you're hearing me. Because I'm not in the car, I'm back in the studio working on my little job here. And by the way, I was also getting some false indications by this. I had an open resistor. No, I forgot the question. I'm sorry. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, K2J.
KC2, here we go, K2GJE was asking about the various kinds of control grid and screen grid current you get with, I think it was a tetrode tube, and I sort of reviewed those, and both he and somebody earlier was asking what all were the conditions that you saw in that 3,500 watt FM broadcast transmitter that had a lightning strike and a bad filament in the tube. What were the original details of all the repairs you had to make? And so, at first you were getting some weird screen grid currents, the plate circuit was out of resonance, and the bypass capacitor needed repair, integrated circuits had been wiped out, the filament of the tube had been blown, and so you were a busy guy getting that particular transmitter back on the air. That transmitter required some pretty serious surgery as I see it, and I think the transmitter is now out of the hospital. So back to you, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hello. Hi, K2RIW, K2EJ. Yeah, the transmitter's been working fine ever since. Actually, tuning it is not such a big deal. When you change the tube, you have to retune it anyway. You know, the inner electrode capacitance is never exactly the same between the two. There was also a couple of open resistors, one being the return supply, which is metered. And that resistor was open, and that gave a false indication of some negative voltage, too. So it was a multitude of problems. It's a full circuitry. I had to replace six chips that were open. I had four resistors that were open. I had four screen bypass capacitors. Actually, one was dead. I replaced all four of them just for the heck of it. And I did actually get a chance to show Rich and a few people what they looked like. They're interesting looking Teflon with just a large area. It's quite simple size. And one of them, after I hit about 200 volts, would arc over it. It was a little pinhole that would arc between them, but it was enough for the control circuit to say something's wrong, so it would shut down immediately. There are other small issues. Actually, one of the automatic power control standby supplies that actually holds the current setting in a set of latches went dead, even though it was a relatively new battery that runs it, but that was another mysterious thing that I found at the end. But all in all, the thing runs like a champ now. And, you know, 1986 vintage transmitter. And the station on the air was a 1952 Gates transmitter with 146 drivers and 4-502, which is a lot of fun. You can see the plates glow red when that thing's not tuned properly. K2RW, K2J.
Yeah, we did have a dropout of the Eastern Machine. Right now, I'm transmitting into the Eastern Machine, coming out of the Western Machine, and the Eastern Machine is off the air. I wonder what we should do to reset that. Anybody got a suggestion? Should we wait for a complete dropout to try to get the Eastern Machine back up? K2LIW listening.
Rick, if you can hear me, I'm going to change the time and duration. Give me a minute and I'll do that.
Roger, Dodger. I just slipped over to the input on 2585 and heard what you were saying, John, but it wasn't coming through the 85 output. So please repeat that message, and I'll listen to the 25 input again to hear what you said.
Okay, what Eric had typed in on EchoLink was about space charge concerning that transmitter you were talking about. So maybe you want to know that. That's what he couldn't remember what he typed in. He said it should be. I hope you copied that thing.
Absolutely, John. And now you're coming through the 2585 normally. So space charge. So when Eric comes back after he resets the timer, so he wanted to give us some words on space charge. With reference to the Tetro 2, KE2EJ, when you're ready, K2RIW, the second half. Right now, the Eastern Machine is still not back up.
And also, Dick, I want to remind you, when it goes into that distorted mode on EchoLink, the people who are listening on EchoLink can still hear everything fine. Just a reminder.
Yeah, glad to hear that, John. Because, so it's only the people listening on the RF output are hearing the distortion. The people on EchoLink are hearing the signal clean. So people like Rich, KGUPS Mobile, for this tractor-trailer truck, I'm still hearing clean audio, and I'm glad to hear that. Let's give a little bit more wait for Eric. KQ2EJ, when you're ready, KQRIW in the tech hat.
Eric would like you to notify NY2H to reboot the Windows.
Okay, please reboot the Windows, Lou. NY2H, I'll copy. KQRIW.
This is NY2H Mobile. 375 just came up again. I'm out in Medford, so I'm trying to listen on the 85, so repeat the question.
Okay, Eric was suggesting that you reboot the Windows to make the Eastern Machine come back up. Maybe that's not required, because I'm listening right now and the Eastern Machine sounds good. So looks like no action is required, but over to you, Lou, and see if that message made sense. NY2H, Mobile, K2RIW.
Roger, roger. Okay. Anyway, I'm on my way home, so I couldn't do it now anyway, but okay, sounds like it's working. You guys continue NY2H Mobile.
Now, I think we went down the list of everyone who had a question. We probably didn't give the complete answer to what you were asking, Ed, but back to you for any final. K2GJE, K2RIW, TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. One further question on the tube that I'm running. I'm running a 4-125A that was available to me years ago at a good price. When I run the grid current at 10 milliamps, the input grid current at 10 milliamps, I get the lowest amount of screen current. This is running Class C, for CW or phone. And I was up to now usually using about 12 milliamps. Just, I don't know, just to have some margin of error there.
Well, I think, at your 4-125A, you used to run it at 10 milliamps, now you run it at 12 to make sure you've got the right amount of drive margin, I think. And you were telling us that, and I believe you were leading toward a question, and I'm not quite sure what the question is. K2GJE, K2LIW, the deck band.
Okay, I'm transmitting on 375 and receiving on 850. Okay. On the, I get the lowest amount of screen cards. If I run less than 10 milliamps on the grid, then the screen card goes up. So I've just been running, rather than the 10 milliamps, which is right at the borderline, I've been using 12 milliamps on the input grid, and there's absolutely no change, even if I go less than 12 milliamps on the change in the current after that, over.
But you are, if I understand correctly, you are getting a significant amount of change in screen current when you go from 10 milliamps of grid drive to 12 milliamps of grid drive. And I've got no good explanation for that. Some chance that Eric might have. Wonder if Eric is listening, and I know he's on duty right now, so maybe this is not fair to ask him.
How to return to work, he said.
This is the captain here, coming at you live.
So it looks like we're not going to get an Eric answer on that one. However, I do talk to him from time to time. Now that I know it's a 4-125, I know you've got 1,500 volts on the plate. I'm going to guess it's in the vicinity of 300 volts on the screen. You did say you're running a Class C, so you're running a significant amount of negative voltage on the control grid. And as you go from 10 milliamps of drive to 12 milliamps of drive, there is the possibility that your grid bias voltage is shifting, unless you've got a very stiff voltage regulator on the control grid bias voltage. That voltage shifting could be one of the factors, I think, that makes the screen grid current go up and down. That's a guess on my part, Eric. Ed, K2GJE, K2RIW. By the way, if you have a way that you can sample the control grid bias voltage while you go from 10 to 12 milliamps of RF drive, if you can sample with a separate meter what that control grid voltage is and what the screen grid voltage is, is either one of those changing, that will give you another clue. K2GJE, K2LIW.
Coming straight to the pie from the captain's chair with my boy, John.
I wonder if you're there at K2GJE, K2RIW. Maybe we'll get back to Ed a little bit later. I think it's time to go to the mailbag, John. AC2WGB, K2RIW, and I'll answer any mailbag question except the one from Roy, AC Jess. Oh, that's a joke. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Oh, very good, Dick. Yeah, we had a great discussion, as much as you know, and Roy was worried a little bit about it being too esoteric, but we have to continue the conversation we had last week. We had capacitors, and the effect it has on the antenna. So I know you have some great information on this thing. That's the Dr. Roy. I'm sure you built it. Putting a lot of effort into this. So back to your dedication to WGB. I sent you the excerpt. I know you have it.
It turns out that of all the popular antennas that we use, the vast majority are so-called standing wave structures. That really means that the signal is going to bounce back and forth a significant number of times within the antenna itself before it gets radiated. And your definition of resonance in order to get efficient radiation means that you want all those bounces to be in step with each other, to be coherent. That's what resonance really is. Okay. If you don't have enough room to install your particular dipole on whatever band, or if for some reason that you're trying to squeeze the dipole into a very small package on a VHF, UHF piece of handheld equipment, one of the things that's popularly done is to add at the end of the dipole, at the tip of the dipole, you add something called a top tap capacitor. In most cases, it is a flat sheet of metal, sometimes round, but not necessarily. It could be square, triangular, but it's a flat sheet of metal, usually at a normal angle, at right angles to the tip of the dipole, and connected to the tip of the dipole on each end. Those top hat capacitors, anybody who has done a whole lot of antenna tuning, just takes it for granted that when you ever add top hat capacitors, the antenna is shifted to a lower frequency. It resonates now at a lower frequency. And so when we say the top hat capacitor adds capacitance to the end of the dipole, we say that to each other. We all know which way it goes, and very few of us have really asked the question, why? Roy, being a good scientist, and a guy who's definitely part of the never finished learning, is asking the question, what's really happening? Because in the case of, let me drop, in the case of an equivalent circuit for a dipole antenna, could have a dipole antenna in a transparent black box, and in another box alongside, you have the correctly chosen inductor, capacitor, and resistor that are all in series with each other. And if you choose the right values of the L, R, and C, when you at that frequency measure the impedance of the equivalent antenna, the LRC, versus the real antenna, you won't be able to tell the difference. So an equivalent circuit is an inductor, capacitor, and resistor in series for a dipole, at least at one frequency. And now, when you add a top hat capacitor, Roy is asking, does that mean that that capacitor equivalent goes up? The answer is sort of yes, but there's a little bit more to it. And I'm going to show you how we can walk into this slowly and understand it a little bit more. Let me drop. Let's say that I made a typical 80-meter dipole out of 14-gauge wire, the way the average guy does it. 14-gauge household wire, 132 feet of it, 67 feet to the right, 67 feet to the left, egg insulator in the center, egg insulator with each chip. Pieces of rope from the tips go to a tree that holds it up at a nice high altitude, and some kind of a good transmission line is fed across the center, hopefully with a balun, and maybe just a poor man's balun, a few turns of coax cable held together with tape. So that's the dipole. Assume that my dipole gives me a beautiful resonance at 3.7 megahertz on 80 meters, 3,700 kilohertz as we call it. Okay. Now I decide to add a 3-foot-long clip lead at the right-hand tip of a dipole and the left-hand tip. I take this 3-foot-long clip lead, clip it onto this horizontally polarized dipole parallel to the ground, and now I've got this vertical 3-foot-long clip lead hanging on the right-hand side and the left-hand side. What happens? Well, the 132 feet of electrical length just became 6 foot longer. It's 138 feet. And even though that clip lead is at right angles to the rest of the wire, remember I've been saying for lots of years, the dipole itself, you can zigzag it left and right, up and down. You can do all kinds of things to it. The only time where life gets complicated is that if you start taking some of the wire of the dipole and you coil it into a helical coil. And now, when you make it into a solenoid coil, a helical coil, now the length of the wire in the resonant frequency starts shifting in a funny way. Let me drop. And the reason for that is that your solenoid coil is now a current concentrator. So as the current flows through that solenoid coil of wire,
your 14-gauge wire may be insulated, and you left the insulated rubber on while you wind it around a piece of PVC tubing, so to speak. Because of the current being concentrated in the center, and the current now looping, encountering each of the turns simultaneously, you've now made a real inductor. And in that particular case, the apparent electrical length is longer than the wire that made up those coils. So when you coil it like that, by helical winding or whatever, all of a sudden less wire is required to hit resonance. You get a funniness. But other than that kind of solenoid coil winding, almost any kind of zigzag up and down, left and right, it's only the length of the wire that really counts. So these clip leads hanging at the end, 3 foot of clip leads, you go through the process of actually measuring the antenna. What used to be 3700 kilohertz of resonance just now shifted down to, my calculation was 3539. So you move from 3700 to 3539 approximately by adding those clip leads at the end. Now, you could, if you had the right resources, decide to put a pair of clip leads on each end, 3 foot long, one hanging down, one hanging up. And you can go the next step of now having a total of four on each end, one hanging down, one hanging up by 3 feet, one hanging to the right, one hanging to the left by 3 feet. You're slowly creating a disc. It's equivalent to what you do at the ground plane radials, the so-called counterpoise on a vertical ground plane antenna. You start adding more and more wires to the ground plane, and it starts acting closer and closer to a sheet of metal in your backyard, so to speak, and the antenna efficiency goes up as you add each extra repeater.
Time out.
Let's see if I... it looks like I didn't time out the eastern input. Okay. So, as you add more and more of those wires, you're slowly creating that sheet of metal. The biggest impact you're going to get is from the first clip lead. The second clip lead is going to give you a little bit more lowering of the frequency. And by the time you add the fourth and fifth clip lead, as far as a top hat capacitor is concerned, which is not quite as persnickety as the ground plane radios on a vertical ground plane antenna, by the time you add four or five of those clip leads, all 3 foot long in various directions, all at right angles to the wire, you've now completely constructed that top hat capacitor. And the instead of being 3539 kilohertz, it's probably going to be at 3500 or 3490, so to speak. What's really happening? Know that in order for the signal to be radiated by a dipole, you send that signal onto the dipole by way of your transmission line. You'd like to believe the signal walks down the wire and just jumps into space. Absolutely not. Good job. All the good books will tell you it's a standing wave structure. Deep enough in the good books, they'll tell you it's got a Q of 10 or 15. You dig really deeper into the people who are digitally using the dipole, you'll find out that it has a certain rise time and a certain fall time. All of these things are various ways of measuring Q of a circuit. There's about five or six definitions of Q. Voltage rise at resonance, current rise at resonance, center frequency divided by bandwidth, rise time and fall time, decay time, energy stored per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle. It sounds like you've got six different definitions of Q. You dig deep enough and you find out all six of those definitions are the exact same phenomena, just different ways of measuring it, different ways of looking at it, different ways of assessing it, but it's the exact same phenomena. So what really happens is that energy you've put onto your dipole from your transmission line, it travels all the way down to the tip of your dipole. On that first trip, about 5% of it is radiated. And then at the end of the dipole, almost all that energy is left over, 95% of it. It's going to reflect back toward the beginning, and that's the first cycle of this reflection. You're going to get 10, 15, 20 cycles of reflection before that signal finally gets radiated, depending on the diameter of your wire, how high up it is, what other reflecting devices, a few variables. But if you rounded it off and said that your dipole has a Q of 10 or 20, and you said that by rough approximation, the signal you put onto the dipole has to bounce back and forth 10 or 20 times before it finally gets radiated, it's very close to the truth. Let me drop. So when the signal gets down to the tip of your dipole where there's a clip lead hanging down, the signal doesn't stop there and reflect back. It goes down the quick lead. And at the end of the quick lead, it says, okay, that's the real end, and now it reflects back. The fact that that's at right angles to the rest of the dipole is a minor perturbation. An extremely small perturbation on the true electrical length of the dipole, almost no perturbation on the radiated pattern of the dipole. The dipole is almost always going to give you that classic donut pattern when you look at it as a two-dimensional diagram. If you look at it as a three-dimensional diagram, it's a so-called red apple with the dimples on the ends where one end where the stem goes and the other end, there's another dimple. Those are at the collinear distance, collinear direction off the tip of the dipole. You're getting a dip in the pattern. The rest of the pattern is almost omnidirectional. That's the real pattern of a dipole. There's not enough real estate there to do anything different. As you start taking that clip lead at the end, and now you add other clip leads, and it finally becomes a complete sheet of metal, the RF energy still does the exact same thing. It works down that wire, it hits the flat plate capacitor, it now spreads out in a radial manner. In other words, it spreads out to the left, to the right, up and down, across that top hat flat capacitor, a sheet of metal at the end. The energy spreads across that in a radial manner, in all radius directions at once, until it hits the outer perimeter of that 3-foot diameter circle that I slowly made. And now it calls that the open circuit, and it reflects back from there. So you can see how the top hat capacitor has electronically lengthened your dipole, even though the real number of feet from left side to right side is still 132 feet. But electronically, you've made it a longer thing, a lower resonant frequency. Now, you're not likely to put top hat capacitors on a real 80-meter dipole. Let me drop it. By the time you get to VHF and UHF frequencies, where maybe you're being forced by your employer to squeeze a dipole-like antenna into a very small handheld package, and now adding the equivalent of a top hat capacitor, maybe it's only two-dimensional, it's a flat thing in printed circuit board, but doing that could allow you to, in a small space, still get correct electrical resonant frequency out of that dipole-like structure. One of the questions that John and I asked each other last night, at the wee hours of the morning, we sometimes do this, these retired people keep crazy hours sometimes, we asked each other, what happens if I carry this to the logical extreme? I'm doing it at a UHF frequency, I'm making the dipole shorter and shorter and shorter, I'm making the top hat capacitors bigger and bigger. Can I still get resonance? Can I still get the same Q? Let me drop it. And the answer is that as you add these top hat capacitors to an ordinary dipole-like structure, and that 80-meter thing I just described, the true bandwidth of that antenna is not going to change very much. The pattern is not going to change at all. It would take a very precise laboratory instrumentation to see the extremely minor change in the antenna pattern when you've added those top hat capacitors. However, as you now decided to carry this to the logical extreme, you're doing it at, let's say, 915 megacycles, where the dipole is in the vicinity of 4 inches long, and you decide to build the dipole 1 inch long instead of 4 inch long, and yet you're going to re-establish resonance by putting top hat capacitors on the right-hand tip and the left-hand tip of a 1-inch long dipole at 915 megacycles. Would that still work? Would it still resonate? The answer is yes and yes. But it's a catch. You're now starting to make a shielded structure. The right-hand top hat capacitor, which maybe is going to be a couple of inches in diameter, and the left-hand one are only an inch apart. You now have created a brand-new capacitor in space. You have these two plates only an inch apart, and you and I could, with 0.225 A over T, that's the formula for picofarads of capacitance. Once you know the area in square inches of your capacitor plate, and it's two of them, and you know the spacing between the two, that's called T. A is area, T is spacing, and you multiply that 0.225, the answer is picofarads of capacitance. So you've made in this extreme example, you've made X number of picofarads of capacitance, and you've got this straight little piece of wire in the middle between the two, which is a shortened dipole. Would that antenna have the same Q? I say no. I'm pretty sure that antenna, the bandwidth would get extremely small. The Q would go extremely high because the only real radiation is attempting to take place from that one-inch repeater.
Time out.
Long piece of wire way down in the middle of the structure is attempting to do the radiation, and it is going to have a tough time doing it because it's almost completely shielded. That's going to raise the Q. However, if you now study a patch antenna is when you start off with a large sheet of sheet metal, and you take a square of metal that's usually the way it's used, or it could be round, a square of metal where the linear dimension of the metal is very close to a half wavelength. When you include the dielectric material, that spaces one above the other. You've got a large sheet of metal, you've got a sheet of plastic or rubber, and then another sheet of metal on top. The sheet of metal on top is the one that is made a half wavelength long. The large sheet is the ground plane, and you make that considerably bigger. And you put the probe between the two just right, that is called a patch antenna. It radiates from the outer perimeter. As a linear device, the far edge on each end, the gap between the two, it develops a great big voltage. That's where the radiation takes place. So this extreme tap hat capacitor antenna that I just described as a mental experiment, where it's 1 inch long of wire and two great big capacitors at the end, John thought he's going to take his small diameter paint can covers from a 1 pint or a half pint paint can, and he's going to use those as tap hat capacitors, soldering on the end of the wire, and see what happens. Put it on a sector network analyzer and measure its bandwidth, measure its radiation characteristics. Let me drop it. So if we try to analyze what is that, is it an extremely short dipole with tap hat capacitors? Yes. Is the dipole down there in the middle of these two tap hat capacitors and almost shielded? Yes. Is it going to have the ability to radiate very well? No. However, the two outer perimeters of the tap hat capacitors is where the signal really goes before it reverses and comes back on each individual mount. It goes to the perimeter. So now you can envision significant voltage at the perimeter of the right-hand capacitor and the left-hand capacitor. You've made a kind of a balanced circuit of a so-called patch antenna. Is it a patch antenna? Is it a dipole? Yes and yes. Will it have a different mode of radiation? No. The patch antenna, with voltages between the tips of those perimeters of the tap hat capacitors, what will that pattern be? You study that pattern, it's going to be very close to a dipole pattern. A little bit different, but not much. It'd be an interesting antenna to experiment with. Will it give you an advantage or a disadvantage? Right now, we don't know. John and I made this mental experiment last night. We started to take what's a lot of fun with these antennas is to take, let me drop it. Take known characteristics where you can make a modification and push it to the limit and see what happens. When I was studying the Brown and Woodward curves, and almost everybody uses the curve near the top of the curve where the distance to A to D is around 1,000. In other words, the distance to diameter ratio of the radiating wire of the dipole of a Brown and Woodward curve, around 1,000 to 1. Your 14 gauge wire on 80 meters happens to be something like 4,000 to 1 ratio. And the Brown and Woodward curve doesn't go there. However, you look at the Brown and Woodward curves, and you go to where the A to D number becomes smaller and smaller. That's really a fatter and fatter dipole. And you start looking down at the end of the curve where the number goes to 4. In other words, the diameter is 1/4 of the length of a monopole. And you suddenly realize that the curve starts getting a very interesting characteristic. It starts becoming almost flat horizontal instead of having a steep slope to it. In other words, the resonance phenomenon almost disappears. It becomes an extremely broadband antenna. I discovered that by looking at that part of the curve, which everybody thought was the useless part of the curve, I think Mr. Brown and Woodward in 1945, when they were doing that experiment, when he dropped it, I think they included that just to be complete. They didn't think that was the useful part of the curve, because the curve became so flat, the Q was going low. They thought low Q was undesirable. Now think about that for a minute. If I'm putting an inductor and a capacitor together to make a resonator, the equivalent circuit is an L and C in parallel, and either a resistor across them in shunt, or a resistor in series with the inductor. The inductor usually has the resistance. As you add resistance to either of those tuned circuits that I just described, the Q goes down, the selectivity goes down, the efficiency goes down. So we all have had pounded to our brains low Q of a resonator in bed. Don't go there. Build it with the best materials you've got, the lowest resistance in the world. You get the highest Q of the resonator. You get the sharpest tuning. You get the highest efficiency. High Q is good. That's been pounded to our brain. And you look at the Brown and Woodward curve, and you look at the bottom of the curve where the A to D is 4, where the Q is very low, everybody assumes you shouldn't go there. Okay. In the case of making a sheet metal 900 megacycle antenna, where it's very easy to make the dipole that's 4 inches long, to make it an inch wide, that's a 4-to-1 ratio, that has low Q. But because it's a piece of copper sheet metal, which has extremely low resistance and resistivity, there ain't no loss. But the bandwidth becomes wide. It's low in Q, high in efficiency, and it's a good radiator. You want to go there. That's good. Let me drop. People haven't gone to that part of the curve before because they thought the Q was low, and they've been told that low Q is bad. When it comes to a resonator, where you want to do selectivity, yes. When it comes to an antenna, where you want bandwidth, it's the opposite. You want the lowest Q in the world. And so therefore, when I, of all those patents of antennas that I've worked on, many of them are very fat. They're so damn fat, you can't even model them with the proper, with the currently available modeling programs. You get an answer, it takes you a long time for the program to set up a zillion little bitty triangles, what do they call it, now, finite elements. It has to set up a zillion finite elements. It takes the program lots and lots of hours of grinding to try to figure out what's going on, and it gives you an answer that's in the right direction, but it's nowhere near the real performance you get. That's a whole area of research of dipole-like antennas, Yagi-like antennas, that hasn't been investigated. And when you look at what Brown and Woodward did with those curves, let me drop. The individual lines of the curve, the round 1,000 to 1 A to D, the length to diameter ratio, the lines are very close together. That's the desirable portion of the curve, he thought, the most frequently used portion of those curves. And down around where the diameter, the length ratio becomes a very low number, 4 to 1, the curves become very widely spaced. He didn't put very many curves there. He thought that was a useless portion. He gave you those curves just to be complete. Didn't realize how valuable they were. I can tell by the bias I see and the way he set up those curves. The curves are far apart down there. He didn't think anybody's going to go there. And along comes K2RIW in 2003, and he says, gee, something looks good there. I've got this beautiful vector network analyzer in front of me. I've got a bunch of sheet metal. It takes me a couple of seconds to cut it up with an X-Acto knife or a scissors, and I'm going to start building wide dipoles and find out what happens. And I said, holy blank. Wow, why has anybody used this all of these years? This information has been hidden in plain sight for 65 blanking years, and nobody knew it was there. So, as you can tell, wide pieces of sheet metal for the dipole itself. By the way, to do it at 915 megacycles, to make the dipole almost an inch wide, is easy. Try to do the equivalent at 80 meters, you'd be making the wire 16 feet in diameter. You can see why Mr. Brown and Woodward didn't want to go there. Nobody's going to set up a 132-foot-long dipole with the wire being 16 feet in diameter just to get the right diameter-to-length ratio. Let me drop the mic. But if you did, you'd get a very broadband dipole. And because of the skin effect, even if you put all of that 16-foot diameter chunk of copper out there, 99.99% of it would be a pure waste. Because of the skin effect, the RF energy would only go down a 10,000th of an inch into the copper. The rest of the copper is just sitting there wasting your money and wasting a whole lot of weight. You could build it as a thin skin of sheet metal, or you could do it as a cage dipole where there's a bunch of wires held up by a structure, so to speak, and that you can fool the RF energy by having a couple of wires around the perimeter and everything else is just air in between. The RF doesn't know the difference, so to speak. In the case of the sheet metal dipoles I was building at 950 megs, they're flat pieces of wire, they're not round. The RF doesn't give a dot. It sees it as a round object, if you know what I mean. It's partially blind. I know, I've talked to them. Let me drop it. So as you can see, there's great advantage of putting top-half capacitors at the right chosen diameter at the tip of the dipole. Now here's the next thing that's a real mind-blower. you don't have to make direct contact to them. You put the top hat capacitors out there, and you space it by a 16th of an inch to an 8th of an inch. You don't get the full performance modification, but you still get a modification. That RF energy goes down to the tip of the wire of your dipole. It goes to that gap between it and the top hat capacitor that you spaced a 16th of an inch away, we'll say, at 900 megs. And maybe you're spacing it an inch away at 80 meters. And still, it sees the stray capacitance between the tip of that wire and the top hat capacitor. It still will tune you to a lower frequency, just not as much. But there's a great advantage in even recognizing that. Let me show you. You set yourself up a good antenna range at 915 megs. You've done it with a vector network analyzer. The vector network analyzer is connected to the driven element of a three-element Yagi made out of sheet metal. Each of the elements is roughly 4 inches long. The whole damn boom of the Yagi is around 4.5 inches front to back. It's got a director, a driven element, and a reflector. And now you want to experiment with finding out, you're measuring the gain, you're measuring the pattern, you're measuring the front-to-back ratio, you're measuring the VISRA, you're measuring the bandwidth, you're measuring whatever you want. You want to find out, as each individual element becomes longer and shorter, does that parameter I'm measuring, which usually is gain and or VISRA bandwidth, does it get better or worse? Let me drop. In that environment, where the antenna range is 3 feet long, I'm not kidding, the antenna on the test is sitting on the conference table, and on my desk, 3 feet away, is a receiving antenna, which is another antenna just like it, by the way, and the two of them are aimed at each other. One is the standard, and the other one's the one I'm tuning. So I've now got a thin, long skewer stick, the thing that you would make shish kebab out of, and at the end of it, I put a small piece of copper tape, maybe an inch square, inch and a half square. And I'm standing, because the stick is 2 feet long, I'm standing out of the field of the antenna, and I'm holding that piece of copper tape near the tip of a dipole, near the tip of a director, near the tip of the reflector. As I bring it near, by the top hat capacitor effect and the stray capacitance to it, I am electronically tuning that particular element to a lower frequency, and I'm watching the screen of the vector network analyzer. Let me drop. And I'm watching the signal get better or worse. The gain goes up or goes down. The bandwidth gets wider or narrower. The center frequency goes up or down. I'm watching whatever parameter I want to measure while I'm bringing this piece of copper tape closer and further away. I'm waving it around the tip of the element. And as I watch the performance getting better and worse, and I find out, does it get better and worse when I get closer and further away, or does it get better and worse when I get further away or closer? It's like a sight-impaired man walking up a hill. The tilt of his feet tells him which way is uphill. By me watching the screen, and I'm watching the display go up and down, as I bring the piece of copper tape closer or further, I know which way is better. If I bring it closer, and the gain goes up, I say, that's good, let's do more of that. By bringing it closer, adding capacitance, and the gain goes up, I know that electronically that element wants to be longer. I pick up another piece of copper tape, and I literally lay it on the tip of the dipole, and I make it electrically longer, and solder it in place, because you've got to worry about the fact that the glue on the copper tape is not conductive. So you solder it in place when you put it there. So you make that element a little bit longer, and now you get more gain. By this tuning procedure, I can tell you each element, does it want to be longer or shorter? I can easily make the element longer by putting a piece of copper tape on the end of the skewer stick as a tuning tool near the tip of that element. Let me drop. By using a slightly larger piece of copper tape on the skewer stick and holding it near the center of the dipole, I am now shunting some of the magnetic field that's there. I am now electrically shortening the dipole. So by holding a piece of copper tape near the center of a driven element, I can shorten it. By holding a piece of copper tape near the tip, I can lengthen it. So with these tuning tools, very rapidly I get a very fast answer, which direction gives me more gain, which direction gives me more front-to-back ratio, which direction gives me more bandwidth, which direction gives me lower VISWA. You can see the tuning procedure. By those very simple tuning techniques, I can test 20 different antenna designs in an 8-hour day. You try to do that by modeling. How do you model that piece of copper tape? How do you model the spacing between it and its shape and the effect it has and all the stray capacitances and the inductive shunting and everything else? By finite element analysis, each individual antenna design would take a couple of hours of grinding on a good machine to give you a partially solution, a partially accurate answer. In the real world, I'm getting the answer instantaneously in real time. See what's going on here? Let me drop. What's really crazy is that the way we teach our antenna design engineers to build antennas, we have taught them that computer modeling is the be-all, end-all. The net result of that is that almost every single antenna vendor in the world, but certainly in the United States, they all brag about the following. We model it first, then we build it. With that philosophy, there's a whole class of very high performance, very broadband, very high gain antennas that they don't know about because the model will not find it for them with the currently available models. As you can tell, I've got a lot of emotion in the subject. I've worked there for the last 10 years steady, done a whole lot of work that I think is valuable. A lot of people are using those antennas. Some of them are in full production right now, doing their job, and various people look at that and say, gee, that's a strange looking antenna. Why the hell are the elements so wide? For a very good reason. As you can see, what Roy has done, AC2GS, has asked us this question, and he's triggered one of my favorite subjects, and I'm giving you a deep dive. I know you've probably got some more questions on this one. Let me first turn it over to John. Am I getting close to what we think Roy's question was? And I'm hoping that Roy is going to have an antenna on his house in Brooklyn soon so that we can hear him directly, as opposed to just communicating with him by way of snail mail or email on the mailbag. KC2WGB, I hope I came close to what you think he's asking, John. If not, correct me, K2RIW in the tech net.
No, I think you're hitting it right on the head. I'm sure Roy will send me an email if he wants Phil's. And I want to thank him for this question. And I don't want him to feel that this is too esoteric, because that's part of the tech net and exactly how they operate. And that's where we're going. We're going on that avenue little by little. And we had a very long discussion last night, and we thought of it from looking at it through different windows. And that's really, I thank Roy greatly for forwarding that question.
Yeah, let me reiterate something here. When you study all of the 5,000 kinds of antennas that are currently known, that's my assessment. Somebody else's assessment, his method of saying, well, that antenna is not really different. He may think there's only 3,941 kinds of antenna. Somebody else may think there's 5,500. I think it's roughly 5,000. Ballpark. Of the 5,000 kinds of antennas, the highest percentage of them are standing wave structures. The so-called traveling wave structures are Graphic and Beveridge, and certain kinds of a helical antenna. So very few of the antennas, the signal flows down the wire only once. That's the so-called traveling wave structure. Almost all the antennas we build are standing wave structures. The signal to be radiated is going to bounce back and forth on that structure some number of times before it finally gets into space. As such, you'll soon discover that a high percentage of those standing wave structure antennas, somewhere buried in that antenna, is a basic element that really is a dipole or a monopole. And even your waveguide to coax adapter, that probe inside of it is really a monopole antenna. So almost all the antennas that we use, somewhere in the antenna, to excite the process, to get it all working, there's a dipole or a monopole. Therefore, once you suddenly realize how extremely important and basic a dipole and monopole is, and you now start studying, how do I really tune one? How do I really use one? At the molecular level, what is happening? What is that signal doing? How is it bouncing around? Why is resonance so important? Why do we keep saying, resonate first, then you can radiate? And why in the world do the good antenna books never say those words? So, although it may sound esoteric, the most basic antenna we all use, to some degree, is a dipole. And the highest efficiency dipole in the world on HF antennas...
Repeater, timeout.
The highest efficiency dipole in the world is the one that's N-fed. Halfway dipole fed from the outer edge requires no ground plane more than just a stake in the ground, or if you do it on the balcony of your apartment building, the metal railing is more than enough ground plane for the counterpoise if you're feeding the 5,000 ohm outer impedance. Yes, you got to do a little bit of fancy impedance matching because you're feeding a 3,000 ohm, 5,000 ohm impedance as you feed the outer edge. In the case of a pure vertical antenna that you set up at a field-based site, that can be an extremely high-performance antenna. One vertical piece of wire held up in a tree by a piece of rope that you set up there by way of a slingshot, and the bottom of the wire comes down to the ground, you're feeding the outer end of this half-wave dipole, and you're feeding it with reference to a stake in the ground, and that can be an extremely high-performance antenna. The simplest instruction, the simplest